In one of the current national debates, Islam or ISIS or radical Islam has been identified as one of the biggest threats not only to the United States but to the rest of the Western world. And that is true, and probably true, given the fact that terrorist acts have been committed in the United States, although you could say they've been small in number. If you go back to Waco, to Fort Hood, to the area where an Islamic member of our military radicalized, apparently, shot up 12 or 13, 14 people killed, and then the most recent example of the killing in San Bernardino, California, with people who were obviously influenced by Islamic radicalism. I think in the future we'll probably find that there is no such thing as moderate Islamism. Islamism will probably all be radicalized at some point in the future. At least that seems to be the indication given Bible prophecy, not that every Muslim will be radicalized, but that's a story for a different time, I suppose. So all of that is true, and all of that is one of the things that in our current political debates of the day has been raised, and even has been raised that Muslims would temporarily be banned, or at least the proposal that Muslim immigrants to the United States would be temporarily banned. And you could have any opinion on this, I suppose, that you wanted to have, but that individual, Donald Trump, has been criticized for that because the political correct train of thought is that you cannot ban a certain group of people from immigrating to the United States. On the other hand, we restrict our own citizens from traveling to some nations in the world, like North Korea, and some dangerous spots in the world, like even Pakistan, which is supposed to be an ally of the United States. So I'm not so sure why that would be such a political hot spot for a lot of people, but it has become a point of contention with some. But putting all of that aside, the topic of the day today in the sermon is not Islamic radicalism or radical Islam. The Bible identifies another powerful movement that is going to suddenly appear on the scene and become an even greater threat to the stability of the world. And if you'll turn to Daniel 11, in a paradoxical way, the Bible may imply, may imply that radical Islam could be one of the instigating forces for this next great movement. In Daniel 11, a chapter of prophecy that you're all familiar with, we read in verse 40 about the king of the north and the king of the south. So in an odd way, it's possible that the rise of fundamental Islam or radical Islam, as it becomes more and more powerful, could in its own way give rise to this other great power, which seems so distant on the horizon from a standpoint of current events. And it really does. It doesn't really seem like it's very imminent now, like it has almost seemed in other times in our lifetime and in our history. But it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. Now, who is the him? The him is the king of the north. The king of the south and the king of the north. And although as Americans, we kind of, whenever we look at a globe, we look at it face on with America front and center, right? And then Europe is over on the far right-hand corner, and then the Pacific Ocean, and then you have to turn the globe around to see the rest of the world. But from the biblical perspective, you have to kind of reorient your thinking to look at the Middle East as probably the area in which on the globe you would normally look at the United States. But if you turn it around the other halfway around the world, you take a look at the Middle East. And so it's speaking about that region of the world in the north of the area of the Middle East would be, directly north would be Europe. So at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land. That would be the area of Jerusalem and Palestine. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Whether there are alliances, or whether they just are able to escape, or whether exactly what the reason the Bible doesn't specify as to why these groups of people who have lived in that various area to the east of the area of Palestine, east of Jerusalem as we know it today, these people have basically been the same. Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. And of course, Ammon is the capital of Jordan, and that's the modern name for an ancient group of people that have lived there for centuries. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him, so the northeast of there. Therefore he shall go out with great fury and destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant, this is kind of a parenthetical statement, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and a glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So it will be a power that will rise, and it will be extremely powerful, and it will instigate a kind of World War III or IV. But the consequences of this particular power are going to be, as the Bible indicates, a much greater significance than what we face today. And it seems so distant and so far away at this particular time. It's almost mind-boggling. The rise of the power of the beast and its domination over the rest of the world will eventually usher in the return of Jesus Christ. And that's the good news. That's the really good news, and his kingdom as well. So what should you know about the beast, and what is the beast anyway? And the power of the king of the north is identified as the beast, and it sounds strange to our ears. And even as you're a Bible student, it may sound very strange to you to hear the terminology beast. So let's concentrate today on a couple of chapters, Daniel 7 and Revelation 13. This will be a review of prophecy, but it is something that we should not forget, and there are other lessons regarding this, not just the identification of these powers of the king of the north, the king of the south, and exactly who they will be, and exactly the format of all of those nations is really kind of unknown to us in many ways now, because as we look at Europe, it's a mess. Europe is chaotic. Europe is in worse shape economically than the United States is. And it's very difficult to see anything rising up out of this conglomeration of nations that has organized itself into the economic union of Europe. And there's many more than 10, as you know. There's dozens and dozens of countries that are a part of the European Union. But 2,000 years ago, John sat on an island, and in Revelation 13, he is explaining a part of a vision that he is receiving. He's on the island of Patmos, and he's right on the Mediterranean. He's at the Aegean, the Mediterranean is all kind of running together. And he says, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea." And he's transformed. I mean, he's already received many other things through the inspiration of Jesus Christ. And now he's seeing this incredible living, breathing thing, so to speak, rising up out of the sea. I'm sure a very monstrous and hideous looking thing. "And I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns. And on his horns, 10 crowns, and on his heads, a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, It's already kind of strange. A leopard is rather sleek, right? Sleek and black, and most of them are black. I suppose there are other colors of leopards, but maybe spotted leopards, but some leopards are black, and they're sleek, and they're fast. And then this one has feet like the feet of the bear, which are very huge and would, you know, make it a maybe either a very powerful leopard or a very clumsy leopard. I don't know, but it would be very different looking. And his mouth, like the mouth of a lion. Again, very strange. The dragon, we know who the dragon is. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. It will be a dominant power. It's not on the scene yet. Europe is not a dominant player on the world stage, or there really is no kind of Europe, because they're all kind of nations that are kind of put together, and they don't have that much influence over the world comparative to their size and the population of Europe. Obviously, they exert some influence, of course, but not the kind of power and influence that is represented in this prophecy. So it will dominate the world, and the people of the world, it says of them that they worshiped the dragon who gave the authority to the beast. So they're worshiping Satan the devil, and they worship the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" Everyone would be afraid. So John is seeing this all unfold. It's a beast that's like a leopard, it's like a bear, it's like a lion. It comprises all of these tendencies. Now, you can hold your place in the book of Revelation, and we'll go to the chapter which also speaks of this same point in the future, in the book of Daniel in chapter 7. In Daniel 7, and in verse 2, we read, "Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night." So he had a dream, and it was a vision similar, very, very similar, as we'll see, as the vision that John got as he was standing on the seashore. "And behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea," that is the Mediterranean Sea. "And four great beasts came up from the earth, each different from the other." Now these are similar, not exactly the same descriptions given in the book of Revelation, but they're all beasts, so they share that similarity. "The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. And after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird." Well, that's a strange-looking leopard, too. "The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And this particular characteristic, of course, is shared by that beast in Revelation chapter 13. "I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the 1st horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words." And we'll get back to Revelation 13 in a little bit. But we see the similarities between these two chapters, that there is a man available speaking pompous things, very similar languages mentioned by the vision that was given to the book of John. And of course, going on in verse 9, I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair on his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, and its wheels a burning fire. And a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000s times 10,000s stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. And I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. And I watched till the beast was slain, and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season. Now going on to verse 15, obviously if you saw something like this, and we can read it and we can understand it from the academic standpoint, but we're not there having it happen to us and having the terror associated with a vision like this and what had happened. In verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by, this is an angel, and asked him the truth of all of this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts, which are four kings, which arise out of the earth. They're later identified not only as kings, but kingdoms as well. In verse 18, it says something that Revelation also says, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So the time period is the time of the end, obviously, as the book of Revelation shows, and as this time. This was not for the time of Daniel, or at least not only for the time of Daniel. It was specifically for the time of Jesus Christ's return, which is mentioned so many places, and of course in Revelation 19. Daniel goes on to say, then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, because this one was so different than the others. Exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, and the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. And I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints, prevailing against them. Obviously, not a time that any of us are looking forward to, when this power, when this government, when this beast will have the authority to do damage to our people, either in our time as we're living or in a future generation or future generations, because we don't know when this is going to happen. And I'll have to say that probably in the, and you know, nothing ever really works out the way you think and project anyway. And I went to Ambassador College in a class that wasn't going to even be able to graduate in 1972, because by that time, God's kingdom might well be on its way from 1972 through 1975, surely 1970. We couldn't possibly, at least in our 19-year-old skull full of mush minds, there was no way possibly, as we were living in the early 70s and going to Ambassador College and studying all of these things, and hearing many sermons and Bible studies about the meaning of these things, sometimes even from Mr. Armstrong himself, who wrote all of the great booklets on the book of Revelation, the book of Revelation unveiled, and 2 or 3 other booklets on the book of Revelation, who set about the beast chart, which many of you have, sometimes some of you, I'm sure, taped into the back of your Bibles. But there was no way in our thinking at that particular time, given the fact, that Europe was beginning in some ways. Now we look back and say, was it really even happening at that time? Europe was talking about, well, all the way back to the 50s, the founders of what became the European Union were talking about a United States of Europe. And there were politicians at that time who were advocating for a powerful union of states that would be similar to the United States, especially because that continent, the European continent, had gone through fairly recently a war, a problem, and they were going through at that particular time a Cold War. And they were talking about these visionaries that we have got to defend ourselves at that time against communism and against the spread of communism. And so there were so many things that were happening, and then the 1973 war came about on the Day of Atonement, and surely that was going to usher in some significant change, and yet it did not. It did not, and we've come to that realization. And so the 70s came, and the end of the 70s came, and things were really bad for the United States. Iran, of all nations, took our embassy employees hostage and held them hostage for hundreds and hundreds of days until Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, in which they immediately released them. And interestingly enough, Iran is now again a thorn in the side of the United States, and we have kind of encouraged it. And I know Jimmy Carter kind of encouraged it back in the late 70s, and certainly the encouragement has been given politically to that nation even recently. To my way of thinking, and even during all of the 70s, it would have been inconceivable to think that we would come now 40 years later and still not have a powerful European Union that is reflective of these prophecies. It was inconceivable to my way of thinking in the mid-70s. We weren't really even supposed to graduate from Ambassador College. Soon after we went through the Yom Kippur War and other things that happened, and it came time, 74, 75, everybody began to realize that any other timetable was kind of out the window at that point. And so we were kind of left with these prophecies, which are still there. And now, in a certain way of approach, all of these things, a dynamic, united Europe, even seems further away on the horizon than it ever was, seemingly at that time, to our way of thinking in the 70s. And that's where kind of the danger is, in my view. Because when you think that the most prominent threat to society in the Western world is Islamic radicalism, then the stage is set at some point in the future, and who knows? We don't set dates. We don't know. But this and the rise of these kingdoms will be the most significant event of, I guess, the 21st century. I can't conceive of us going on for more generations and more generations and Jesus Christ still not returning. But this is going to be, and as I said, in a paradoxical way, perhaps it will be Islamic fundamentalism and the grip that it has among its adherents. Perhaps it will be that, which, of course, we realize that in its form, in its purest form, not necessarily adopted, as we know, by all who practice the Islamic faith, but in its purest form, it absolutely hates everything in the Western world. It hates the modern world that we live in. It hates everything about what Western civilization it is, as I said a number of weeks ago, truly coming to a clash of civilizations. And some people see that. Some people recognize that today. You certainly recognize that today. Others outside the churches of God recognize that today. But even still, that which is going to happen on the European continent looms ahead. We just don't know when, but we don't want it to catch any of us by surprise. In verse 18 of Daniel 7, notice the differentiation, and perhaps one of the most important things to keep in mind as we await all of this. The saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. This is a different kingdom, and it's not characterized by a beast. It's characterized by a totally different attitude. But the fourth beast of Daniel, of course, is the same one that came that John saw hundreds of years later in Revelation 13. The delineation is made in verse 18 of the kingdom of the saints. And we call that kingdom the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom from heaven. This is a kingdom that descends not from above, but it comes up from this earth. And it has all the basest characteristics of this earth. Now, let's turn to the book of John, chapter 3. And let's talk about you, the citizens of that kingdom, and some things that we must never lose sight of as the people of God. This is the time that Nicodemus came at nighttime to speak to Jesus and ask him several questions. He asked him, in verse 2, he said to him, rather, Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher come from God, that no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. And Jesus answered, seems like an abrupt jumping into the comment, most assuredly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. The New Revised Standard Version says in verse 5, as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly man. There are some translations that translate verse 3 as one from being born above. We know the kingdom of heaven is from above. I'm not going to get into what I think has been for some throughout the last 30 years in the Church of God or the greater community of the churches of God, what I think is a silly, controversial point, but nonetheless, it's there. But we are told that unless we're born again, or unless we're born above, from above, we cannot enter into that kingdom that Jesus Christ says that he is going to usher in at the return, at his return, and at the breaking up of this world dominant kingdom, which doesn't seem to be anywhere on the scene right now. But keep that in mind, and let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verses 47 through 49. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 47 through 49. Paul says, the first man was of the earth, made of dust. The second man is the Lord from heaven. That would be Jesus Christ. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are made of dust. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those who are heavenly. And as we who have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly man. Our citizenship is from above. It is from heaven. That is where we eagerly await for our Lord Jesus Christ, our Savior. In Philippians chapter 3 and verses 20 and 21, Trying to keep my voice a little lower here because the baby, I don't want to wake the baby. We have a baby that's trying to sleep for those of you in Sierra Vista and El Paso. I've woken up a lot of babies in my time, so I try to, me even my own. Philippians chapter 3 and verse 20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly await for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body that it may be conformed to his glorious body, according to the working by which he is able to subdue all things to himself. As the people of God and as Christ's servants, we don't look to the earth or its inhabitants for our solutions. We're in the United States, at least anyway, and we tend to focus on the United States politically and economically and almost exclusively. If you follow world events, it's hard not to. It's the most dominant nation on the face of the earth. But I found when I lived abroad, and I found when I lived in England, that we were forced to adopt a different view because you're not given the news of the United States all the time. You're given the news of the United Kingdom and then the continent and things that are happening all over the world. And sometimes I listen to the BBC on my Sirius radio, my satellite radio, and you get a totally different perspective by listening to them. We're Americans, though, and we're used to listening to American news, and that's what interests us. But regardless of where the news or where it comes from or what is happening in whatever country you happen to be living in, the politicians and the leaders of those groups of people and our groups of people do not have the ultimate answers. Only the Bible has the answers for us. And we are citizens of the land, and we should be good citizens, and we should obey its laws, and we should, you know, but our citizenship is not of this earth. And the solutions to our lives don't fall within the realm of this earth. Even though, you know what? I'll bet to a certain degree, one degree or another, if you're like me, you kind of get into following world events, you get into seeing some of the problems that men have, and it can drive you absolutely bonkers to see the stupidity and the mistakes that are made. And if only they would do this, if only they would do that. It kind of runs through my head as I'm driving around and working and listening to the radio and listening to all the problems of the world. If, you know, there are things that they could do that would solve this problem or that problem, and sometimes I guarantee you that I get caught up in it. And yet, the ultimate solutions to man's problems are not here, and they're not going to come from any political leader. And we can be admiring of traits of individuals and human beings and the good things that some people do. We can, you know, certainly follow the good examples of good people and good leaders and all of that sort of thing. But in essence, for every single one of us that is here today and every single one that is listening to this sermon today, the solutions are not found from this earth. From this earth to us, because all of that is characterized in the Bible as lowly and sensual and devilish in nature. Our citizenship is from the kingdom of heaven. In Colossians chapter 3, Colossians chapter 3 and verses 1 through 7, this is where we look for leadership. This is where all Christians, all the people of the Church of God, look for leadership. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. That ultimately is where we look for the future. Now, I have a friend who's in the church, and he's a very dear friend, and I have a conversation with him almost every day. He's one that went to college with me in my class in Brickett Wood, and we have stayed friends with one another for lo these many years. And you know, to give you an example as to how we stay up on current events and how we're interested in what happens on the national scene. I hope he's not watching today. I haven't given him the password so he could watch. So anyway, none of my kids will tell him that I mentioned him in the sermon. But in the beginning of August, before the first of the Republican debates, I theorized to him that the candidate, Donald Trump, was finding a tone that was resonating with the American people, even though on the surface he would say some things that were, you know, really getting him in hot water. It seemed as though the more he said, the more popular he became. And so I told my friend that after the first debate, his popularity would continue to rise. And he said, "I don't think so." This is when Donald Trump had a popularity rating of about 20%. And I said, "I think it's going to go up." And he said, "No way. He's done, you know, for the last time, he's done something now that, whether he was talking about stopping all Mexican immigration or his comments about Mexico or whatever, that got him in supposed hot water at that particular time." I said, "Well, I think he's still going to get more and more popular." And actually, he did. And has. And of course, my friend denied that that was going to happen. He said, "No," he says, "I think he's reached his pinnacle. He's not going to get, he's not going to get any more popular." And I said, "Well, we were both going to the feast in Hawaii last year, and there's a golf course there called Kapalua, and they played last week's tournament at this particular course. And it's a beautiful golf course, and it's very expensive in the place that I would only go to play golf when I had second tithe that I was able to afford to play there, because it costs about $250 for a round of golf." And I said, "Well, I tell you what, I will bet you a round of golf at Kapalua this year that he will get more and more popular." So we played at Kapalua on a Tuesday. And all I can say is that I didn't have to take my wallet with me. So we do follow those things. And he kind of misinterpreted my soothsaying, or my prophesying, as it were, or my prediction as support. And he still does, and he gives me a hard time about that. But be that as it may, I'm not looking for Donald Trump or any other candidate, any of them who may be good or right or logical in their thinking, to provide the solutions to mankind's problems or the solutions to our country's problems, certainly not long term, and neither should you, because we are told to set your mind on things above, not on the things of the earth. And there's a very good reason for that. "For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them." And we all came from this earth. We were all a part of this earth, or this body, or this world, and we were subject to its influences. And in this sense, it's very similar to the passage in Ephesians 2, where Paul mentions that that's the life that we left behind. That's where we came from. We were all influenced by the earth. And obviously, we still live on this earth, and we're still influenced by its systems and its governments. But what is coming upon this earth is going to be so powerful and so deceptive that a Christian cannot allow himself or herself to be swayed in any way, and must be prepared for what is coming ahead. Now, let's go to John again in chapter 3. the one that we should emulate, of course, in John 3 once again, in verse 13, notice, "No one has ascended to heaven, but he who came down from heaven, that is the Son of Man, who is in heaven." As a part of a kingdom, Jesus Christ came down from that heavenly kingdom, and that is where we are to put our trust. Our prayer, as Christ said in Matthew, is that God's will be done on this earth as it is in heaven. And our treasure, Christ said in Matthew 5, is not stored here on earth, but in heaven. That's why I've always encouraged people to not throw their gold and silver in the streets, as prophecy indicates will happen. Just give it to me for safekeeping for right now. I'll be happy to. It's going to be worthless to you or anybody else, but if you want me to have it, then that's fine. I'll be happy to take it off your hands. In chapter 12 of John, John chapter 12, and verse 46, "I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. If anyone hears my words and does not believe, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command, what I should say and what I should speak. And all of that came from a heavenly kingdom, not from this earth." John chapter 16, and in verse 28, "I came forth from the Father and have come into the world. Again, I leave the world and go to the Father." Jesus Christ came from heaven to announce, to lead, and to staff his kingdom. And he has called you to be a part of his staff in that heavenly kingdom, which is going to be on this earth. Let's look at James chapter 3. James chapter 3, I don't think we necessarily need more encouragement about that, but just to show you that there are many, many other scriptures that talk about what is a part of this earth, and the kingdom that is going to dominate world affairs is going to be so powerful that most of the rest of the world is going to be totally deceived by it. Verse 13 of James chapter 3, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic." And you see it everywhere. You see it everywhere in the world today. You see it in every system. You see it in every aspect. Not that there's not good in the world. I mean, Adam and Eve partook of a tree of good and evil. And there is both good and there is both evil in the world. We all know that. But overall sense of things is that envy, self-seeking is not of this earth. It's demonic, for where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. And then the very famous exhortation about wars and fights and where they begin. James wrote that every good gift, every perfect gift comes from above. That's God's teaching, his Son, the good news, the gospel message, the Holy Spirit. All of that originates in heaven. James is contrasting God's wisdom from above with the wisdom that is from this earth, which is sensual and demonic. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13 now. And again, in the first part of the chapter, John is seeing what comes out of the sea, which is also a part of the earth. And it's going to be confounding to virtually the entire world. And they're going to be amazed, and they're going to worship, as it says in verse 4, the dragon, which gives all of its authority to this beast. And in verse 5, he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, all pretty simple, all exactly the same as we find in Daniel 7. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months, or 3.5 years. Now, hold your place there, and you probably don't even have to hold your place with a hand or a bookmark or anything else. But it says in the previous chapter in verse 9 that the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. Now, the whole world is deceived to a certain degree, one way or another, in some areas of the world, more in one area of religion, and in other areas, another form of religion exists, but it's still deceptive. There are some that seem to be more peaceful. Buddhism seems to be more peaceful than Islam, etc., etc. But they all have their base in this world. Christianity has its base, so to speak, in what has come from God from above, but it has been transformed. And the transformational power will again come on the scene in terms of Christianity. Not that their teachings will change, but certainly its power and its influence over mankind will change. So the dragon is cast out. He deceives the whole world. He's cast out to the earth, as angels were cast out with him. And then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, "Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night was cast down." And remember, Daniel was inspired to prophesy that this beast would make war with the saints of God. They would persecute the saints of God, and that is mentioned here as well. Verse 11, "They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death." There have been martyrdoms of Christians in times past. The future also foretells a time of Christian martyrdom, the true people of God. "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time." Now, when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. It's not the topic of the day. It's not the topic of the message or the sermon today. But the protection of this woman has led the people of God to believe that God will supernaturally protect some of the people of God during the time of the end, or during these last 3.5 years that precede the time of Jesus Christ's return. Wouldn't we all like to be protected from this horrible time that is going to come upon the face of the earth? Yes, we would. But the fact is, we don't even know if we're going to live out through that time. We don't even have any idea when this time is going to be. And I'm not so sure that the Bible indicates that you really have a choice. But in verse 15, "So the serpent," in every case, "so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood." Some have theorized, some have speculated that this might be governmental intervention, as the matter, or as the manner of persecution by the church, which kind of would seem to make sense, because governments have been involved in persecuting, and this persecution, this coming persecution of the people of God, seems to be at the behest of this particular beast that is mentioned both in Daniel and in Revelation 13. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, who understand what Christ said and understand the implications of that kingdom. Now back to Revelation 13 and verse 6. Then he, the beast, opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. The entire heavenly host, the angelic realm, God himself, and Jesus Christ. And it was granted to him, that is the beast, this government, this kingdom, to make a war, to make war with the saints, and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Worldwide domination, the likes of which Europe is not ready to assume at this time. All who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. That is all of us. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with a sword must be killed with a sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints, knowing that there will be one who will execute retribution on those who do these hideous deeds at the time of the end. That they're going to get their comeuppance, yes, sure, but that Jesus Christ is going to return. Verse 11 correlates very well with what Daniel says. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. More of that in just a second. Let's go back to the book of Daniel chapter 7 once again. Either I or my father, whose Bible this was, that I use it because it's got big print, either he or I tore out the little place marker in it that you probably still have in your Bible, and I wish I had in mine, but I don't. Verse 24. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise with them, and he shall be different from the first ones. He shall subdue three kings, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, just exactly what happens in the book of Revelation, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Well, that has been done in the 300s AD, at least partially. The Sabbath day was done by the decree of the emperor. The Sabbath was changed. The true day of worship was changed to Sunday. And then the saint shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time, 3.5 years once again. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. As it says in Revelation 5 and verse 10, they shall dwell on the earth and reign with Jesus Christ. Shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. That kingdom is coming. The origin of these beasts of Book of Revelation 13 and the beasts of Daniel 7 are of this earth. They're not from above. The staffing of these kingdoms comes out of the sea. It comes out of the earth. It comes from the peoples who will submit to it. Its speech, its teaching, its blasphemy, its hostility towards God's holy ones of the people of God is of the earth, It's of a satanic origin. And in verse 13 of Revelation 13, it says that this horn, this beast, this other beast, it says he performs great signs so that even fire comes down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So there will be some who will stand up, and yet they will suffer martyrdom. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. Not going to go into the mark of the beast today. That's a topic for another time. But it says that that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast of his name. It's not an imprint. It's not a tattoo. It's not a computer chip implanted in your forehead or your brain somehow that identifies you as having the mark of the beast, suffice it to say. So the second beast that is mentioned here is also shown in Revelation 17. This beast in Revelation 13 that exercises the authority of the first beast is also pictured in Revelation 17 as a woman riding another beast. In verse 17, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, "Come, I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away into the spirit, into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup, full of the abominations and filthiness of her fornication." Fornication is a wrong sexual relationship. This fornication is a spiritual wrong relationship. And on her forehead a name was written: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. This is the beast of the earth. And even as if you're on a horse, you're a lot smaller than a horse, but if you have reins in that horse, as powerful as the horse is, you can control the movements of that horse, unless it's just a wild horse. I mean, if it hasn't been tamed, but even if it's wild to some degree, if you're a good horseman, if you ride a horse which is a lot heavier than you and much more powerful than you, you can still control its movements. And if you train it, and this is what happens. This woman is not as powerful. This woman is a picture of a church. It is that other horn, but it controls the movements of this great beast. It controls the movements of this kingdom. Now, it's incongruous. I started talking about the American mind and the American point of view and our system of government. For the most part, until kind of recently, we haven't had a king. But we have had democratic rule in which your opinion is supposed to count. And it's still, to our way of thinking, it is incongruous to the American state of mind, where we have individual freedoms and liberties, which are still protected by a document. It's hard for us to imagine a dictatorship. But it's only been in the last 300 years since the origin of this nation that there has been a place on earth in which, for the most part, its entire populace has had individual decision-making and still had a lot of rights and freedoms that were granted by law. For most of the people that have lived throughout history have not lived under these kinds of circumstances. They have lived under systems that are dominated by the imperious will of a king or a dictator, and there are places like that on this earth today. Still on this earth today. And there have been, even in the 20th century, there have been those times in which certain nations have been governed by dictators and harshness. And, you know, we have read about them in the history books, and we have, some of us have lived through some of those times. And yet that is the way the entire world is going to become in the future. And all of this that we cherish and we love is eventually going to be wiped off the face of the earth by this dominant kingdom. Years ago, hundreds of years ago, before the 1800s, from the time of Christ up until the time of the end of Napoleon's reign, governments were basically ruled by the church. From the 300s AD, let's say, up until the time of Napoleon, governments and the resurrections, as we would call them, of the Holy Roman Empire had this kind of arrangement that is spoken of here. Many of the popes had their own personal armies. Popes would go to war. You can read of that during the time of the Middle Ages. That's mind-boggling to us who have grown up in this system. As mind-blowing as these prophecies are, they're difficult to understand because we still have our way of life and we still have our freedoms and our individual liberties and so on and so forth. But even as Churchill said, that an iron curtain was falling across Europe when he spoke about the communistic rule that, you know, took over Eastern Europe, there is going to be this darker time that is going to come upon the face of the earth, and it's going to be done at the behest of a powerful church, the likes of which are unimaginable to us. Not only will this church have an agreement with this great state that is going to arise up out of the earth and the sea, but it is going to have this woman that is going to have it do its bidding. Now that's stupefying to us, because in our system we have a separation of church and state. That time is going away in the future. We don't know how near or how far away that is, but it's characterized as being so maddening that it's drunk with the kind of power that it has, and even that power over the saints. Verse 12 says, "These 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast." So just for a short time speaking. "And they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For the Lord of lords and the King of kings and those who are with him are the called, chosen, and faithful." Brethren, this time is coming. I can't tell you when it's coming. It's just coming. And while we're concerned, and I think rightly so, if for nothing else than a round of free golf, we're concerned about what happens in the world today in our own political system. Let's not lose sight of the fact that something far worse is going to supersede some of the cares and the worries that we have today. And I'm not saying that to discourage you. I'm just saying it's going to happen. But don't be blindsided. But the only thing that is going to help us, as it says in Luke 21 and verse 36, is to watch and pray. Our spiritual condition is very, very important for the times ahead.